I have a projector this morning, which I haven't had used in a while, and it's only because I'm going to be talking about a little bit of geography, and, you know, it's hard to picture in your mind geography, you know, and most of us have not been in school for a while, so anyway, we're studying through Genesis, and we're in chapter 2, verses 10 through 14, as you see on the screen there. And this is an unusual passage in the scriptures because we know that the Bible is a spiritual book. And yet we have some details here that seem to have nothing to do with spirituality whatsoever. Why is this mentioned in the Bible is my question this morning. And so I'm going to give you a reason why you may not agree with me on this, but I'm going to give you a reason that I've come to understand from several of the books I've read on this, and you can either take it or leave it. You know, a continual theme in our study of Genesis is that even the earliest chapters, a continual theme in this study that we're doing here, is that even the earliest chapters are historical. As you may remember, those of you that were here, Chapter 1 is not written in a poetic sense. The grammar construction of it is actually of a historical context. And the same is true of Chapter 2 and Chapter 3 and following. And yet many people think that these earliest chapters of Genesis are either poetry or mythology, and therefore they write them off as the history not being credible, and therefore it helps to undermine the credibility of the entire Bible, because much doctrinal foundation is laid here in the earliest chapters of Genesis. So that's the reason for our study. So let's look at Genesis 2, verses 10 through 14, and we'll read verse 10. "And a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and became into four heads. The name of the first is Pison, that is it which compasses the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good. There is bdellium and the onyx stone. And the name of the second river is Gihon, the same is it that compasses the whole land of Ethiopia. And the name of the third river is Hiddekel, that is it which goeth toward the east of Assyria. And the fourth river is Euphrates." So you can see here we have the names of these four rivers. We have some lands that are mentioned. We have some characteristics mentioned about these lands. And yet there's not one spiritual lesson here that I can see, at least, not off the bat. So let me make the point again that Genesis is not mythology or mere allegory, although I do believe that the true narratives, the true history that is told in Genesis, does have allegorical counterparts that the later writers use to make spiritual points. So it is history, but yet it is used sometimes in an allegorical sense. But because I do believe this is true history, I believe that Genesis can be trusted, and that here we have evidence for the inspiration of and the fidelity of the later spiritual messages that we read in the Bible. Now, that there was such a place as Eden with four rivers that proceeded from it, from the one river that split into four, I don't believe that that should be doubted. I know many do doubt it, but I believe that we should take it for what it says. And given the fact that in this passage that I just read, there are so many detailed particulars, you notice that? There's some detail here, that's evidence for the fact that it is not allegory. When people tell allegories, they tell a general storyline, but they don't give this kind of detail. So that kind of hints at the fact that it is history. Now, as we read through the early chapters of the book of Genesis, it is astonishing the amount of detail that is given concerning place names and certain aspects of geography, and it is these details that lend credibility to the Bible. It is these kind of details which are either absent or grossly exaggerated or provably erroneous in other religious books. Now, I didn't go into detail with this, but I do, for instance, know that the Book of Mormon makes some geographical claims and such about the New World, but they've all been proven erroneous. But the Bible's history and geography has never been proven to be erroneous in any way. It is important to remember that the Christian scriptures are historical in nature. I've made that point over and over again. They are historical in nature. That's what makes Christianity so different from other religions. And because it is historical in nature, therefore, it is anchored in a true reality by a true God, and therefore it has a true message. And this gives credibility to its spiritual message. The spiritual message Brother Ron just mentioned about our justification. One of the reasons we can believe in these spiritual issues is because of the truthfulness of the Bible. Now, these details that we have before us today discuss the names of places and geographic features of the world as it stood before the flood of Noah. We need to keep that in mind. This is all before the flood of Noah. And as we'll get to the text of the flood of Noah, that completely rearranged the geography of the world. So the description we have here cannot be found. There is no place like this anymore because the flood of Noah destroyed it all. But as we read this text, we find some startling things, some facts and details that at first we kind of just run over and say, oh, that's nice. But when you actually examine them, you see that they're kind of unusual. And the first of these is the fact that the descriptions of these places are all written not in a past tense, but in a present tense. Chapter 2 was written in the present tense, not in the past tense. Now, we all understand that Moses compiled the book of Genesis. But Moses lived many centuries later after this time period. If Moses was to write a description of Eden, he would have written it in the past tense if he were to write it in that way. But obviously God directed him to write it in this present tense. So that's the first unusual feature, and I'll mention why that's important in a moment. Whoever gave the account, whether written or oral, may have been passed down orally through the centuries, he addresses his details to the reader as if the reader was there with him in the garden, as if the reader could have looked and seen. It's addressed in such a way that, and we know Adam was there, for instance, without Adam could have told the story to Eve and said, look, these are the four rivers. So he addresses it in details as if the reader was there with him, living out their daily lives right there with him in this pre-flood world. Now, that of course makes it unusual. It's also, we need to consider, and I've hinted at this already, that the pre-flood world was destroyed beyond all recognition by the flood. So this, the way this looked, was completely rearranged after the flood. And of course, Moses lived after the flood. How could Moses have known what this looked like in that time period? He couldn't have, unless an eyewitness gave him an account of some kind. Now, God himself, we know, could speak to Moses directly and tell him word for word, this is what I want you to write down. And I've got no problem with that. I think that's exactly how it happened. However, what we do remember, too, is that many of the people of that time lived for many periods of many years. Like, for instance, Adam lived for 930 years, according to the Bible. I believe that's true. Methuselah lived for 969 years. I believe that's true. And what you may not realize is that Adam lived all the way up to the time of Noah's father. So Adam could have literally told Noah's father about the way it was. And then Noah's father could have told Noah about the way it was. And then Noah went through the flood with his family. And this story, or this recounting of this geography, could have been spoken of many times over and passed down to Moses. Or, as I've hinted at in previous lessons, it could have been written on clay tablets. And we'll talk about that more as we study the book of Genesis. So how could anyone after the flood have written about the rivers which flowed out of Eden and what lands they encompassed, what lands they went around? I was going to turn at this point to Genesis 7 and talk about the great destruction of the flood, but I don't think we need to do that. And to save time, we'll skip that. But in Genesis 7, you can read about how greatly rearranged the geography of the world was. And we'll get to that one day. But what you may have noticed in our text this morning is that several place names are familiar to us as names which were prominent in the post-flood world. For instance, Ethiopia. We know Ethiopia is even called that today. There's a land called Ethiopia today. Assyria is mentioned. Brother Ron in the book of Isaiah has mentioned many times about Assyria. And Assyria was always an enemy of the Jewish people in the earliest days before Babylon rose to the scene. We read here about the Euphrates River. Well, we have a river today named the Euphrates River. And so we can see that many of these lands and places are prominent in the post-flood world and even in our world today, these names. Now, could these lands and this river or these rivers have survived the flood? Could the Euphrates River, the one we see today, be the same Euphrates River as the one mentioned in our text? Let me see if anybody wants to offer an opinion. I see a good head shaking back there. Head shaking, no. It would be kind of, there's no way after the flood that it could be the same rivers. So what's the explanation then? Why were there rivers and lands named this way prior to the flood, and yet we have the names of rivers and places after the flood named this way? Anybody want to conjecture why? To be remembered. That's a very good point right there. That's the nature of humanity. We remember the things of the past, do we not? And many times we do that with the things we name. We name our children many times after either ourselves or perhaps their ancestors. We take their middle names or whatever. And for instance, in my family, my middle name is Warren, and the middle name of Warren has passed down through the generations. Every son got the middle name Warren until mine. And then I was egotistical enough to give them my first name, Mark. So my kids have the middle name of Mark. But the simplest and most likely explanation for this is that the names made it through the flood. Not that the lands and the rivers did, but these names were passed on and recalled and paid homage to the past. By renaming the rivers they found and renaming the lands established according to the names as they were in the days of Eden. But what's interesting, if you read the geography here carefully, you'll see that the geography doesn't always match. And that also tells us that this was quite different than what we see today. Now, here's an interesting thing to note in line with this, that the Babylonians called their land, and if you recall, the Babylonians are one of the earliest civilizations. In fact, the one prior to them, called the Sumerians, were established in the Mesopotamian Delta. And this is where I'm going to move to the next slide here. I tried very hard to get good maps. I didn't have a lot of time to work this week, but this is the best I could come up with, this one and the next one, and I'm a little frustrated because they're not exactly what I wanted. But at least in this map here, you can see the area that we have called Mesopotamia. In fact, you'll see the title of this slide is Ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia in about the year 1450 B.C., and that's about the time of Moses, maybe a little after Moses. And obviously there is Egypt. But this area here, known as Mesopotamia, is marked out by two great rivers, the Euphrates River that runs down like this, and the Tigris River that runs down like this. And so this area here, where Babylonia settled, was also the land where the Sumerians were, and they were the earliest civilization that we have writings from. And so So what's interesting to note, though, that the earliest Babylonians, the Sumerians and such, actually called their land Edenu. And you can see that's very similar to the name Eden. Sounds a lot like Eden, Edenu. And the same territory was also known as Bit Edenu in the Assyrian tongue. Now, you'll notice here is Assyria, and Assyria was also in the Mesopotamia region, and they were a later empire, but they also used the same word, Edenu, to describe their land. And both names seem to have been an attempt to perpetuate the pre-flood name of Eden. I didn't look it up, but I'm sure there must be some even towns or places today named Eden. There's a desire to look back and remember this. But there is a glaring difference here between the rivers as we have them described here in our text and the rivers as they ran through the land of Babylonia. I just pointed out Euphrates and the Tigris, but how many rivers did I point out there? Two. And how many rivers do we read about in our text? Four. So there's an obvious contrasting difference right there. So let's look just a little further. Pause right there. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the four rivers in particular. Now, the first thing we read is that the one main river, which watered Eden, parted or divided into four river heads. By the way, let me mention also at this point that the word Mesopotamia, anybody have any idea what that means? It's, I can't remember if that's Greek or Latin. I think it's Greek. It means between the rivers, between the two rivers. It looks somewhat like Potomac, Potomac River. I live in Maryland, Virginia, Potomac River. So that means between the two rivers, and of course we only have two rivers. Now the names of our rivers given in our text are Pison, Gihon, Hiddekel, and Euphrates. And these names denote the following things. The first one meant flowing freely and spreading. The second one meant gushing forth as with a rapid motion. The third one meant breaking forth as in childbirth. And the fourth one meant being fruitful or bearing fruit. So you can see they all had the idea of plenty, flowing freely, lots of water. And so their names describe a land that was well watered. And we know that Eden was a garden. And the world at this time was a perfect world because Adam hadn't sinned yet. I like what Matthew Henry says about this. He said, "These four rivers contributed much both to the pleasantness and the fruitfulness of this garden." You may recall that the land of Sodom was also said to be well watered. Remember that Lot desired to go to the land of Sodom because it was well watered. And it was also described in Genesis 13:10 as like the garden of God. Or the garden of the Lord, I should quote it right. The garden of the Lord. So now observe, we're talking about a very fruitful river system with a garden and much plants. And so we can observe that God, what God plants, he will take care to keep well watered. Now, after the flood, when the children and grandchildren of Noah began to repopulate the earth, they would have had memories of the lands and geography from before the flood. Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth might have then told them stories of what it had been like before the flood. And remember, too, that Adam would have lived until the time of Noah's father and could have described for them what Eden had been like. So the names of these rivers would not have been unfamiliar to Noah and his family. These names would have been something they knew about. And these descendants of Noah would have been the earliest settlers of Mesopotamia. And so, in remembrance of the time before, and we have these great rivers well watering the land here, what did they call them? Well, they called one of them Euphrates. And Euphrates, as I just recalled, meant bearing fruit or being fruitful. This was a well-watered area and was fruitful for growing crops. That's why they settled there. Now, what's interesting, too, is the other river that we have here is called the Tigris today, but it's not always been called the Tigris River. Anybody know what the previous name of that river was? the Hiddekel, just like our text here. The Hiddekel. That came from the ancient Akkadian and Sumerian language, and it got translated into the Persian. The Persian version is a lot like Tigris. And so no scholar today questions that the ancient name of the Tigris River was actually Hiddekel, just as we have in our text. Now, here's something interesting. Turn with me to Daniel 10, verse 4. Daniel 10, 4. And remember that the whole point of all this is that we can trust the Bible. And God, I believe, put many things in the Bible just to give it verification. And we're going to have here in Daniel 10, 4, the name of one of these rivers. I'll read it to you, and then we can talk about it. And then the 24th day of the first month, as I, that's Daniel, was by the side of the great river, which is Hiddekel. Now, Daniel wrote many, many, many centuries later, but he was in the land of Babylon at the time. And he said he was by the Hiddekel River when he wrote this. Now, what's interesting is many people try to say that, oh, Daniel was written many centuries later than it actually claims, and that it was actually written after the Persian period. But Daniel is actually writing this, as he says in verse 1, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. And he uses the ancient name of the river, Hiddekel. But if this was truly written after the exile, as many critics claim, it would have been more likely for it to have been written as the Tigra River, which is the Persian word for it, the Tigra. But Daniel uses the word Hiddekel. And I believe this is a hint that Daniel was really writing in the days that he said he was writing. So this helps give more evidence to the book of Daniel's authenticity as well. So in our text again, though, the two lands we have mentioned are Havilah and Assyria. Now, Assyria is familiar to us. Havilah is not. But what's interesting about Havilah in our text is that the riches of it is emphasized. Now, that seems a bit strange for a spiritual book, right? Why? Because, I mean, we're not to love the riches of this world. We use them to accomplish God's purposes, but we're not to set our affection on them. And yet this kind of sounds like almost coveting the land of Havilah. It says in the final part of verse 11 and verse 12, the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold, and the gold of that land is good, or I assume it means pure or plentiful, and there is bdellium in the onyx stone, which are also bdellium, as I understand it, was a precious spice, and the onyx stone is a precious gem. So here we have gold and spices and precious gems of that land. I like what, again, Matthew Henry says here in concerning Havilah in his commentary. Matthew Henry notes its riches, but then he does give it a spiritual bent. He says he then contrasts it with the land of Eden. Sounds like the land of Havilah might be better than the land of Eden. Eden's just a garden with trees and fruit and etc. But Havilah's got the gold and the spices and the gems. And then Matthew Henry notes this and contrasts it with Eden by comparing Eden's relative poverty, or actually he compares it with the spiritual poverty of Havilah with the unsurpassed glory of Eden, and deduces this spiritual message. He says this, quote, Havilah had gold and spices and precious stones, but Eden had that which was infinitely better, the tree of life and communion with God. That's the way we ought to look at this. Eden had that which was infinitely better, the tree of life, eternal life through that tree of life, and communion with God. That is the kind of thing we should seek. So in contrast, yes, Havilah had the earthly riches, but Eden had the spiritual riches. They have the gold, but we have the gospel. The gold of their land is good, but our riches are infinitely better. I like that. It's good to keep things in that kind of eternal perspective. We can get so tied up in the world. We're all trying to get along, get by in this world, but we need to keep the spiritual, eternal perspective in mind. Now, clearly, much has changed after the flood. When we consider when Noah came out of the ark, when we consider the desolation and the emptiness of the world, which the earliest families of Noah and his descendants had to settle into. Remember, everything was destroyed. We'll get to the text, but there was not even plant life. It took a little while for that to develop while they remained in the ark. Is it not then to be wondered that the peoples that came later here, Noah's descendants, should try to perpetuate the names of the old pre-flood world as they had known it, particularly the word Eden? It was only natural then that they should also name the lands adjacent to these rivers by the lands that were listed back then. For instance, Assyria, after the pre-flood land of that name, which had also stood by the river Hiddekel. Now, you know, I think you're already on this wavelength, but I'll just mention this quickly, that this is nothing more than what settlers have always done. And think of North America. Think of where we live, particularly with we have New England. We have Boston in Massachusetts, but there's a Boston in England. We have London. There's a new London, Connecticut. There's a London, Ontario in Canada. There's Cambridge. A suburb of Boston is Cambridge. So many of the settlers who came to America renamed their towns according to the towns that they had left behind in England and other places, too. I'm sure the Germans and the Dutch and everybody else did the same thing. Yes, there we go. Memphis harkens back to Memphis and Egypt. So clearly, this is a common practice to name a new city after an old city. So we cannot say with the critics that the pre-flood Assyria is the same as the post-flood Assyria. There's no reason to believe that they are the same. And in fact, what's interesting is in our text, it says that Assyria, that the river Hiddekel is that which, the verse 14, which goeth toward the east of Assyria. It's on the east side of Assyria in our text. But if you look, the river, the Tigris River, which is the same as Hiddekel, kind of went right through the middle of Assyria on this map here. So we have these differences, and yet the similarity of the names. And so that kind of testifies to the fact that we're not talking about these same places. We're talking about places that were named in remembrance of them. We also have, I'll just mention that Havilah, for example, there were three countries actually named after the flood by Havilah. Two of them lay in Saudi Arabia, and they were down here. And another one was over here. So you can see they had nothing to do with anything up here. They were just remembrances of the name. And Havilah, as we'll get to Genesis 10, was actually a descendant of Ham. And so was Cush. And so Ethiopia and Cush are also countries. And if you're not familiar with this, Ethiopia and Cush is actually the same name. It's just two languages. I think it's in Ethiopia is the Latin version for Cush. And actually, you may have a note in your Bible. The word actually in the Hebrew here in Genesis 2 for Ethiopia is actually the word Cush. So the Cushites, the Ethiopians, are the same people. But obviously, if Eden was somewhere up here, well, Ethiopia, I don't have it on the map, is down here in Africa, or the land of Cush. And so you can see that they could not possibly be the same. So let me conclude. Before I conclude, let me ask if there's any questions at this point or any kind of comment. I did have one other slide, and not that it's that important, but it was just a little more blown up of that area. This is the Euphrates River, and this is the Tigris River that came down, or as it's called in Genesis 2, the Hiddekel, if I'm saying that right. Let me just point out one other thing. This is just an interesting thing, because most of these names, you don't even recognize them. You notice this little place here called Ur? Who came out of Ur of the Chaldees? Abraham. He came out of Ur of the Chaldees. This land was also called the Chaldean land, Babylonians. It's all the same place, just different names for it. But if he came out of Ur of the Chaldees, he was deeply in the heart of this land. And he had to travel a long way. And he had to travel up the river system to cross, to get over to Israel. So that's why he comes down from the north into the land of Canaan. Okay, so by noting the discrepancies and the commonalities in this text, what we can say by noting the discrepancies is that the writer of Genesis, or the recounter of Genesis, if that was Adam, knew absolutely nothing of the geography of the post-flood world. If the writer of this knew of the post-flood world and knew that he would not be believed because nothing was the same, would he have written it this way? Probably not. So this is kind of evidence that whoever wrote this, and I'm not discounting Moses here, I'm saying whoever gave the accounting of it, whether they passed it on to Moses orally or they passed it down to Moses by a clay tablet, did not know what the post-flood world looked like. So he wrote it as he saw it. He was writing in the pre-flood times of a pre-flood world that he knew and that he saw. And so he uses a present tense to describe that world. If we were describing our territory today, we would be describing it in the present tense. We talked about Memphis as it is today. That's the way we know it. And so that creates these disagreements, these discrepancies. But the point I'm trying to make, if you think about it, is that this helps to lend credibility to the text. This was written way before the later texts. Three of the names that are found in our text appear again in Genesis 10, the Table of Nations. We're going to get to that. The Table of Nations is very important in Genesis 10. And in the Table of Nations, the three men there are Cush and Havilah and Ashur, which is where the name Assyria comes from, the land of Ashur. And they all had lands named after them in the post-flood world. But the men themselves lived after the flood. And so they were given their names based on the lands from before. So scoffers may say, see, these men and these nations named after them, they all came after the flood. Therefore, Genesis 2 must have been written after the flood. Therefore casting doubt upon the antiquity and veracity of these early chapters of Genesis. However, there's a perfectly reasonable explanation, which I've kind of gone on about. It lies in the fact that it has been common throughout history for cities and lands to be named after earlier ones of fame and renown. The land of Cush certainly was named after Cush, the son of Ham. Havilah was named after Havilah, the son of Cush. And Assyria was certainly named after Ashur, who was also a descendant of Ham. But it is not unreasonable for us to deduce that each of these men were named after the historical early lands mentioned here lying outside the land of Eden. So the takeaway to all this is, I believe that believing in the authenticity and reliability of the book of Genesis is very reasonable. I understand people will disagree with that, but hopefully you can see that it's at least reasoned and reasonable to believe that. And therefore, the Bible can be trusted. And that's what I hope we all walk away with this morning, is the Bible is a trustworthy book that our whole lives depend on, our eternal life depends on.